Hey there, dog people of the internet. It's Sarah Stremming, the Cog Dog Coach, and this is Cog Dog Radio. Join me as I cover behavior concepts, discuss training ideas, interview experts, and explore my cases, all regarding the dogs we live and play with. Let's go.
Everybody, I've got Monique Fairchild back on the podcast this week. You'll remember Monique from a previous episode. She is a licensed veterinary technician with a specialty in behavior, and she is my go-to for all things cooperative care. The second edition of her textbook, Cooperative Veterinary Care, is available now through Wiley Blackwell. It's what sparked this conversation, but this conversation went so deep that I had to cut it in half. So this is the first part. Enjoy. Welcome back to the podcast. Will you share your name and pronouns with the listeners?
I am Monique Fairchild, and my pronouns are she, her.
So the long-awaited second edition of Cooperative Veterinary Care is finally out, and I hadn't finished thumbing through it when I sent you a message, and it was something along the lines of they should put up a statue of you outside of veterinary clinics. It was some ridiculous, like, all hail Monique message, and then I said, so when do you want to jump on a recording? But this is a textbook for veterinary professionals, and I want you to start with kind of the why. Why is this textbook so necessary? Why does this resource need to exist?
Oh, man. So really big view for me, just from my experience working in the profession and working with a lot of veterinary professionals who I care deeply about, in addition to caring deeply about animals, I think that this is a super important work because it helps us feel good while doing good. And the ability to have good mental health as veterinary professionals is critical to our ability to continue to work and continue to help animals. And one of the ways that we can have better mental and emotional welfare for veterinary professionals is to allow us to be nice to animals while we're taking care of them. Because I think we work at the vet because we like to be nice to animals. And then when we're asked to do things that are really emotionally hard on the animals that we feel really connected to, it really takes a toll over the long term on our own emotional welfare as humans. So like the really big deep reason is because I want veterinary professionals to have a more fulfilled life. How's that for cheesy?
Monique, number one, I didn't expect you to say that. Aww. And I'm so happy that you did say it, because I know I'm at least thinking of one dear, dear friend of mine who is a veterinarian who sold her clinic after a really, really serious period of burnout. And this is part of the burnout for her. She learned through meeting me a lot about dog behavior, a lot about dog body language, started to be less and less comfortable with the daily in and out work that she was doing. And that is such a big deal, because I think we think about this stuff as for being for the animals. And it is. It's not for the animals. But what a big... Hey, I'm just really excited you said that, because it is so also for the professionals, because you don't get into vet med because you want to brutalize animals and pin them to tables. Like, you get into vet med because you want to help them.
Exactly. And so I want people to be able to fulfill their vocation of helping and not just helping bodies. Like, we're going to work with pets and not just work on pets.
Yeah. I'm just going to sit back and awe and be like, I'm just going to sit back and like keep getting goosebumps about the things that you say. So, okay. As I'm reading this textbook, I'm finding how simple actually a lot of steps are that can be taken today in veterinary settings that will make things more comfortable for the animals. Because I do also think there's this like fear of the, oh, this is impossible. My clients won't do all this training. Like, my staff can't do XYZ, you know, whatever. But actually, there are so many simple steps. Can you go through some of these really simple changes that I think most clinics could do right away to change the patient experience and therefore the staff and also client experience?
For sure. So, I mean, there are a million easy things that we can do, but some of the easy things that we can do that cost $0, because like also we work at the vet and we don't have a ton of money, so $0 is helpful, is to control traffic in your hospital. So instead of having four dogs in the waiting room, and then there's a cat also that's may or may not be in a carrier and all the things, staff can take the initiative to control traffic in the waiting area. And there are a lot of different ways that we can do this. One of the easiest ways is just to have clients call or text from the parking lot when they get there, ask them to wait where they are, and then invite them in once you have an exam room free for them. And clients, at first, we have to train them about this. But once we get the clients in the habit of doing it, they will help us. They will get in the house. They're like, oh, I'm here, I'm calling, or here, I'm here, I'm texting. Or if they need to come in to pick up a prescription or some meds or some, you know, some food or something without their pet, I notice that they come up to the window and they peek in to see if there's any animals. And if there are, they wait.
Yeah. And yeah, we trained them during COVID. Like, we all learned.
Right. Yeah. Keep it.
Yeah. We all learned how to operate this way during COVID. I have always operated that way because number one, all of my dogs are very special needs, and probably because I'm special needs, right? So like, this is just a whole situation, but like, I've never been one to just walk into the exam, into the waiting room with my dog. That's never been my experience, but I know that I'm not normal. So in COVID, yes, I learned then to just make the phone call rather than walking in without my dog and saying, hey, I'm here, but I'll be in the car. It was relatively seamless. Like, sure, you'd have an occasional person kind of blow past the signage and walk in, I'm sure, but it's an occasional person. It's not everybody. So I would love to see more clinics kind of holding on to that as far as controlling that traffic flow, because if you've got this small little, obviously, ideally, you've got, if you're building a clinic from the ground up, you can do so much more for traffic flow, but like, it's not that hard actually to just say, hang out. When we're ready for you, we'll give you a buzz.
For sure. And if you are a listener and you don't work at the vet, be like Sarah and advocate for your own pets. So just because there is a waiting room, that doesn't mean you have to wait. It's okay to take the initiative on the customer side and say, hey, I'll be here. Just let me know when you're ready for me. Both of those things, totally legal and both helpful.
Yeah, really helpful. So what are some of the other really simple changes?
Really simple things. This one costs a couple dollars, but it's not like many expensive dollars. Get on the internet, buy a roll of yoga mat, and be happy that you did. You can buy a yoga mat in bulk. You can cut it to whatever size you want. We all know, and this is called dogs, so we're going to talk mostly about dogs today. We talk about cats in the book as well. But we all know that there are many dogs that are concerned about slippery floors. And if we look at the work of, for instance, Temple Grandin and livestock, one of the biggest fears that she talks about is slipping and feeling unstable on your feet. Anytime we have an animal coming to the hospital, they have a certain amount of emotional capital that they can spend on their visit. And if I am spending those little coins from the dog's emotional capital on slipping and sliding on the floor across the lobby into the exam room, that's emotional capital that they don't have to spend for an exam or vaccines. Like, I've used up that money that they had for me on something that was totally unrelated to care. Yoga mats are great because you can throw them in the washing machine. You can hang them up to air dry. You do not have to do any kind of crazy maintenance on them. And when they get really tatty, you can just toss them. So that's another easy thing.
Game changer. Game changer for so many situations. Like, dogs universally do not like slick floors. There's obviously a range of like how well they deal with it, but universally it's not a great experience for them to be slipping and sliding around on floor. And if you just think about yourself, like if you had to enter the doctor's office on roller skates, like how would that go for you? Like, I'm just going to say that as a person who needs medication to walk into the doctor's office, if I also had to be on roller skates, this would be a big problem.
I love that analogy so much. So good.
Maybe if you're amazing at roller skates, then that's one thing. But the yoga mat hack, and this is for clinics or pet parents can do that, right? So like, if I'm the dog owner, I can bring in my own, and I frequently do. But a clinic could also have a role of it, and just because I think sometimes the concern is like cleanliness for sure, but mentioning that they can be thrown in the washing machine. I was today years old when I learned that. Like, I didn't know that. I have one that I'm going to throw in this afternoon. Are you kidding me?
So a couple tips on washing yoga mats. Do not attempt things that you learn. They do really well in the washer. I tell people you can put them in the dryer, but it's a neat trick that you can only do once, especially if it's on high.
Yeah.
Lessons that you learn when you have new kennel team members who don't have a lot of experience being adults who do laundry. Also, you need to regulate the ratio of the load of laundry that is yoga mats to non-yoga mats. Please do not try to wash an entire washing machine full of yoga mats. It will not end well. Toss it in there, toss a couple towels, and be happy and content with a slightly smaller load of very clean laundry that does not break your washing machines. I just don't want anybody to get the, and then the other thing I will say is if you have a central agitator in your washing machine, it becomes a lot more complicated. So
open tub
washing machine best suited for yoga mats.
We love these tips. This is great. It did not occur to me that I could do that. And now I'm very excited to know. Okay. So we've got controlling traffic flow. We've got yoga mats. Any other quick, easy, simple things?
For sure. Quick, easy, simple that vet staff can do. Ask clients before they come if their dog is scared of going to the vet's office.
What does that do? Yeah.
So if we know in advance what the animal may or may not find concerning, we can prepare much more effectively for their visit. So there are a lot of different questionnaires that you can send out. You can get really extra, like my office is really extra. I mean, we know this, but you know, we have on our website, their little questionnaire, it goes to them as a text. They can click on the link and fill it out. It's optimized for mobile. And it says, it just has check boxes for some of the common things that animals are scared of at the vet. Like, is your animal scared of being in the waiting room? Are they scared of going in the door? Are they scared of being on the table? Are they scared of having their temperature taken? Are they scared of getting a shot? What are these things? And we can look at that stuff before they come in and tailor their visit. So if we know that they're scared of being in the waiting room, we're going to make extra sure that they don't have to be in the waiting room. If we know that they're scared of being on the table, we're not going to put them on the exam table. We're going to know in advance, hey, we should plan on doing an exam on the floor. So perhaps there's only one exam room in your hospital that doesn't have a table or has a big enough space on the floor. That's the exam room that's for that animal. If we know that they are scared of having our rectal temperature taken, we're going to decide, is that actually a need? Like, do I need that information or do I just want that information? And is it better for that animal to go on their clinical signs versus brute forcing our rectal temperature? We can also learn what the animal likes. So part one of our questionnaire is, what are they scared of? And part two is, what do they enjoy? What are your pet's favorite treats? What are your pet's favorite games? Do they like toys? Comma space, make sure you bring all that stuff with you when you go to the vet. And that, what that does is prepare us so that we have some stuff on hand. I mean, we have a billion things, right? So we're kind of ready for most things that dogs like, we've kind of figured out. But it also prepares the client to try to create a better experience for their dog before they ever show up. It reminds the client or alerts them to the fact that their pet's emotional welfare is important and that we care about it. Mm-hmm. And it gets them in the mindset of us working together with them as a team to protect the animal's emotional welfare too. Because one of the big things, I think one of the big hesitations that veterinary practices have in embracing something like cooperative care or embracing something like fear-free is they feel like clients won't like it.
Mm, for sure.
Because they have to come back again, or they have to, you know, it might create extra visits because if the dog isn't ready to do the things that we want to do that day, and those things are wants and not urgent medical needs, there's always a possibility that we're going to pause an appointment. We might stay, we might reschedule, whatever. And in the veterinary community, we have a long history of being taught you need to do it the first time and you need to be efficient and fast. And so we've taught our clients that we're magical, efficient, fast people that can do all the things. And then we worry that if we change that, our clients won't like us anymore.
Yeah.
One of the strongest things that you can do is start planting that seed in the client's mind before they ever show up, that there's an emotional component to this visit and that you care about it, because then they are way more likely to team up with you as a veterinary professional if you need to pause an appointment or make a new plan. And so it gets rid of some of that fear that we have about doing it. Also, $0.
$0 to just have that conversation up front. And I mean, you know that I'm extra too. So like, I'm obsessed with this. Like, this is so great. And I love that you kind of, you're linking in several benefits here. So just asking what the dog is afraid of or what the dog is worried about, or if the dog is afraid or worried, does both of those things. Like, it informs the staff of how to approach this dog best, but letting the client know that you care about that is such a huge deal. And I feel like this is, you know, I sometimes have a similar conversation with dog trainers that they're like, well, Sarah, your clients are special. Your clients go do above and beyond things. And to be honest with you, my clients are normal people. They just, I set an expectation. Like, they're not even asking me for help unless they are in line with my expectations that I've already put out there. Like, I've already said, we're going to do a deep dive into wellness. This is not just going to be about modifying one little behavior. I've already said, this is going to be complex. And anytime we're trying to change behavior, it's like peeling an onion and we are just going to find more and more, I promise you. And that's how it's going to look. Like, I've already said it all. So yes, they're ready to do all of that stuff. And if they're not, I'm not for them. And it's kind of like, yeah, if you want to be a clinic who cares about the mindset, the mental health of these animals, and not just, like you said, you're treating the whole animal and not just bodies, just kind of reiterating that message as much as you can, bringing that message back to the conversation as much as you can. I actually think people might be surprised how many clients are really perceptive to that.
You know, usually once people get in the swing, they are surprised and pleasantly so, for sure. Do you want my last two easy? Do you want my You want my last two easy things? And then I have one thing that is extra hard, but it may be the best thing ever.
Please. Yes. Let's have it.
Last two easy things. If you are questioning clients in advance and doing some pre-communication, make sure that you screen for car sickness.
Oh, huge.
If these guys are car sick on the way to the vet, nobody's going to have a good time and you can fix it in advance. So ask and act. Car sickness is the enemy for...
It's the enemy.
For all the things, but yes.
It's the enemy. It is the enemy. Like, I trust as a behavior consultant as well. It is such a problem. Thank you for saying that. Okay. Next easy thing.
Next easy thing. There are a million free resources in the universe about this. So like Fear Free Happy Homes has a million free videos and podcasts and all this kind of stuff. I have a YouTube channel that has a ton of free stuff. Just like link it to your website. It's cheap. It's easy. And then let your client see that and then let your staff work through it at their own pace. If the book feels like too much, if it's too much money, if it's too much energy, there's a ton of free stuff out there. Go look at it.
It's true. Okay, so
link it to your website.
Love it.
Send it to your staff, post it on Slack, do whatever you do internally to communicate, but make sure that the staff has the education that you think they do. Because, and this happens with us with pet owners, right? As consultants, this happens with me with pet owners, it happens with veterinary professionals. The deeper you get in it, like the more of an elder human you become, it is so hard to remember what it's like to be new.
Yeah.
And we start to get to this place in our brain where we forget that other people don't know things that feel simple to us. Yeah. Or we assume that they have it in their brain already instead of checking. And when we have new staff, especially young staff, it is so easy to assume that they know what body language looks like. It's so easy to assume that they know that a dog that takes 1.5 seconds to go through the door instead of 1 second like it normally would is afraid. They need that information and education, and all that stuff is out there in the wild and it's cheap and free. So
we love that.
We love
cheap and free. Okay.
We do.
You have a kind of hard thing, but that's a big thing.
Oh, I have an extra hard thing that's the biggest thing and the best thing, which is do as much as you can as a veterinary professional in the exam room with an owner. Let them see what we do. Let them see. Let them see their pet. Let them see the team. Let them trust you. And it really isn't necessary to take pets to the treatment room for most of the stuff that they're doing during our regular office call.
I'm sorry. Okay, can you say that louder for the people in the back? That it is not
extra loud.
So I just had, not that long ago, Dr. Jessica Heckman and I had a conversation on the podcast that you probably heard about what the research states of like what we kind of quote unquote know in the scientific community about pet stress in the vet clinic. And it is one of the biggest things that we know is taking the animal away from the human is hard on them. And I like that you also brought it back to like, let people see. It's not just minimize stress for everyone. It's like, don't let this be an out of sight, out of mind situation. I think that's what happens. Folks bring their dog in. They have no idea how traumatic and terrible something might have been because they didn't see it. Or they have no idea how easy something might have been because they didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think that it's just this, it's this separation that, again, does not help your mission of treating the entire dog and not just the body. If you want the clients on board, you have to let them be involved as much. And I love that you're acknowledging that this is challenging too, because Heckman and I tried to acknowledge that we know that that's challenging as two people who do not work in that setting. But I do think having it be kind of a cultural shift is it big important. Can you talk a little bit more about why, even though this is really hard, you're saying it's the biggest thing. So talk about it.
It is the biggest thing for so many reasons, but we're going to try and, like, you know, encapsulate a few of the most important reasons. It addresses the thing we were talking about earlier about client pushback, where we are concerned that we might have to do it. We might have to pause a visit because an animal is stressed, or we might have to schedule them to have sedation or this kind of thing. And so we might hesitate to embrace some of these methods because we're worried they're going to cause extra visits. I think part of the reason that we worry about that is communicating to the client what happened when the pet is stressed. And if that feels hard, it means we were working in the wrong room. In general, most pet owners, especially pet owners who love their pets enough that they take them to the veterinarian and give us money in exchange for, you know, health, most of those guys live with these pets all the time. They know their pets very well. And if their pet is upset, they know. Mm-hmm. And if they don't know, we have a poster on the wall that we can point to and say, hey, see, he's yawning, but he's not tired. Or, hey, see, he shook off three times, but he's definitely not wet. Like, let's talk about this. And mm-hmm. we can educate them. But if he's shaking off three times in the treatment room, the client can't see that. They don't know. So they didn't get the body language education. They didn't get to see that their animal was stressed. And when, if we disappear the pet into the treatment room and then we do some stuff and then we come back and we say, hey, you know, we tried that, but it wasn't going to work. So we need to do this other thing. Which is the next point that I want to make, is oftentimes veterinary professionals are very perfectionistic humans. We're perfectionists. We like to get things right, and we like them to be good. And it is all kind of a mind game, really. It's all in how we frame things for ourselves and how we frame things for the client. So if I approach a procedure that I'm going to do on an animal with or without the owner present, and that conversation looks like, hey, we're going to try this, but if it doesn't work, then I need to do this other thing. We're already setting up a narrative that is really unpleasant for us, and it is undermining trust from the client.
Yeah. And I think that... Oh, this is big. This is, I mean, like you said, there's a lot of reasons.
It's the biggest one. Like, this is the big thing.
Big, deep reason. And I don't think, being a person who has been very close to a lot of veterinarians, like, I've got a decent chunk of them who've been the most important person in my life for any period of time, right? And so I understand this deep discomfort with saying I couldn't do my job for whatever reason. I also understand that this way of thinking and being might be one of the reasons you went into it, but then it was totally fostered in school. Like, it wasn't, you weren't helped in school to be less like this in any way. and and then having a client in addition be like, well, this worthless person couldn't do blah, blah, blah. Whew. Major, major problem, right? And like you said, putting this text out so that the staff, the doctors, the nurses can feel better, safer in their jobs. This is also part of it. Like, having this client communication. I have clients sometimes who say, like, my vet is resisting my desire to sedate for certain procedures. This all ties right back to it. I haven't had huge problems with it, but I also am, like, really upfront and communicative with any vet staff that I'm ever working with, like, right out the gate. And they just, already put a little tab in my file like the second I walked in, because I already emailed them 3 times. So like they they know. But like
they do. There's a mark in there. I'm sure they know. There's a mark in
there. Of course there is. And my dog's primary care veterinarian is somebody who like does agility. So like I actually see her on weekends too. Like, so it's just a whole thing. But like basically I think this piece of like, if the person is involved, then they understand what it means when you say, this isn't going to happen today. Here's the reasons. You saw the reasons with your eyeballs. And this is for us to take care of this entire animal and not just the body. And don't worry, because we have a plan. We're going to get it done this way with this plan next time.
Well, I mean, and it's like treating anything else, right? Like if we're in the exam room and the dog has an ear infection, mm-hmm. which ear infections, super common, also very painful. Mm. And dog has an ear infection and we look and say, oh yeah, he has an ear infection. And we explain to the owner, he has an ear infection. We're going to need to treat him for this. He's probably going to need some antibiotics and some antifungals, but it's also painful. And I'm also have good reason to believe that having a painful ear treated is scary.
Yeah.
The good news is I have medicine for fear and I have medicine for infection, and we're going to get both, and done deal.
What an amazing way to communicate, right? And again, like it is basically everything always comes back to communication. Like anytime a behavior professional and I are talking and they think they're having a compliance issue with their clients, they're not. They're having a communication issue. Anytime you think you're having a compliance issue with your dog, you're not. You're having a communication issue. It isn't about, well, they won't do it the way I want. It is about, I've not effectively communicated. What an amazing way to communicate. Here's everything that's wrong. It's not only the ear pain. It is not only the infection. It is also the fear of this visit because we have pain on board. Like that's treating the entire dog. That's saying, here's all the things. We're going to treat all the things. What an amazing way. I mean, can you be my human doctor? This is what I mean.
You do not want me to be your human doctor.
No, of course I don't. Of course not. But like also, you help me actually. When we have these conversations, I learn better how to advocate for myself. And I think one of the reasons that I am such a fierce advocate for my dogs in the veterinary setting is because of my own history of medical trauma and the fact that like, it's just not tolerable for me to see them being, see their entire self not being treated. Your mental health is part of your health. It is not separate. It is the entire picture.
And I mean, if we want to talk about the human model for just a minute, there is how to say this in a way that is appropriate for a podcast. One of the worst feelings in the world is to feel like you're not being heard.
Yes.
One of the best ways in life to feel unheard is to be a woman who goes to the doctor.
It
is just a reality and it is wildly uncomfortable. If we're having any trouble having empathy for pets feeling uncomfortable at the veterinary office, the thing that feels the most uncomfortable for them is not being heard. Having all of their subtle body language not fall on deaf eyes and deaf ears and no response to all that communication that they're kicking out. It's the same. I think it's very hard to find a human being who has never been frustrated with their human healthcare team for their lack of communication or lack of listening or lack of time or all of these things. And all of that boils down to not being heard and understood. Same thing. Same. Calm as face. Your comment about human healthcare. And you're like, can you be my doctor? And I'm like, nope. Because so many becauses, but it reminds me of an important thing to say when we're talking about working with owners present, which is squeamishness is an issue. Mm. Like there are some human beings who are not meant to be around needles, blood, pus, anything.
Yeah.
They aren't made for it. And that's okay.
And you're going to ask them.
You're going to ask them every time.
You're going to ask. Yes.
You're going to ask, hey, here's my plan. Here's what I would like to do. How do you feel about needles and blood? And you can tell by the number of times and speed that they blink what the answer is going to be. Like, just look at the other human animal professionals I'm talking to you. Look at the human being when you are asking them a question. Observe their nonverbal and verbal communication and listen to understand, not to respond, and then go forward. If I have a client who is squeamish, I keep the pet where they are and I'll advise the client to go wait in the waiting room for a few minutes.
Rather than taking the dog to another area.
Correct. This is another $0 quick tip, right? Every time we move a pet from place to place, place to place within the hospital, they have to reorient to that environment. That takes time and it takes emotional capital for them to do that. And I don't want to spend that. I don't want to spend the time. I don't want to spend that emotional capital. I don't want to clean up two messes because I'm lazy, right? So I keep the pet where they are and the client can just step out. Like if the client can't do needles and blood, that's fine. That's okay. I will take the same care of your pet when you are not in the room as I would if you were in the room. Their welfare is very important to me. Also, please don't faint on me because of lack of communication.
Yeah, because we don't want that. And also just from the folks who are listening who are pet owners, who don't work in the staff, like if you're saying, I want to stay for this procedure, also if you know you've got a problem like that, ask specifically what's going to happen. And this is a self-advocacy moment for you. If you aren't going to be okay with a little bit of blood or whatever it is that's happening, then you do need to remove yourself.
Correct. I've had one client faint on me ever. That was the day very early in my career that I learned that I needed to be a better communicator. Yes. One of the many lessons that we learn in life. Mm-hmm. I was giving the dog eye drops of all things. And one drop came out and the drop hit the dog's eye. And I started to see out of the corner of my eye, just this very 6'3" person was now 6 feet tall. And then 5'9" and then 5 feet tall. And I was like, oh, maybe I should stop doing the eye drops now.
I was just trying to think as we were talking, what would I not be able to deal with? Because I don't consider myself squeamish, but there's definitely lines. And I was kind of probably stuff with eyeballs. And then you just... I can give eye drops to myself. I'm not that bad, but okay. All right. That's a thing. So, okay.
Okay.
In the book, we're going to kind of jump. We have already hinted at this next conversation plenty of times. So you categorize, obviously everything in the book is for cats as well, but we're talking about dogs because here we are on Cog Dog Radio. So you talk about categorizing dogs into kind of three types and 1, 2, 3, and we'll talk about that. But also, and I love this because this is so important for the pet owners. You categorize treatments, diagnostics, procedures, whatever, into wants and needs. And then there's essentially an algorithm for what level of stress are we? And is this a want or a need? So I want you to explain both those things and kind of how they work together to make decisions for what you're going to do on the day.
There are a few different patient evaluation tools out there that assign some kind of score. And one of those things that a lot of humans are familiar with is the idea of a pain scale. So you go to the doctor and on the wall, they have this cheesy poster with a whole bunch of smiley and then less smiley faces. And I mean, the last one, just for me, it would be a dude with a knife. I don't do the black black frowny face with the X's for eyes. No, that's not me. I'm homicidal rage would be my 10 on the pain scale.
Yep.
But we're used to this idea that there's a continuum of the experience. Tell me what your pain level is from 0 to 10. I made my scale a lot smaller. Mine only goes from 1 to 3, but it is a way for us to observe the animal's specific behaviors. And then we can assign what we think their emotional comfort is in that moment. Category 1, category 2, category 3. If I have somebody who is a type 1 dog, it is easy for them to come up to me. It is easy for them to take whatever they like from me. They are actively soliciting information from me and interaction with me, regardless of if I am touching them or trying to do something to them or not. That is the simplest way to explain it. If I look like a vet person and I am doing vet things, they do not care and are just as happy to see me as they were before I was trying to do vet things to them. Okay. In the book, we go way deeper and a lot more finesse about that. But that's the very short version. Then I'm going to skip up to 3.
Yeah.
Okay. So 1, easy things. 3, hard things.
Yeah.
If I have an animal that normally really likes treats and can't eat, that's a 3.
Yeah.
So sorry. And I think it's easy for us to assume that three would be like the dog that's lunging and barking and growling and that you can't touch and you can't get within 100 feet of the dog. Okay, so that dog is also a three, but three is maybe a lot milder than people anticipated. So if you normally like food and you can't take food, you're getting a three. If you normally like social interaction, but you're under a chair, you're a three. Everything that's in between those two kind of falls into two. So either you're totally comfortable and relaxed, or you are experiencing distress that is diminishes your ability to function as a dog. Like you're either really happy or you can't dog,
Yeah.
and everything else in the middle is a two. If I have a patient who is a three, they are not going to get anything done to them that is not an absolute necessary need today to keep them like alive and out of terrible pain.
Alive and out
Those
of
are
terrible pain. Like, this is not, well, we need annual blood work.
absolutely
That's
not.
actually a want.
Because
We
we don't
want.
need annual blood work. We want annual blood
We
work,
want.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So we have an algorithm in there, and it says first, we're going to assign a score to the behaviors that we're seeing. Now we need to understand that we're oversimplifying this, just like this is like, look at a photo of a dog and tell me what they're thinking. We all know that that doesn't work, but we're limited to verbal language. So we're going to just have to go with this in the moment. They might be a one for saying hello. They might be a three if they see a syringe. This is going to be fluid and dynamic depending on what the level of interaction is in that moment. But we have a tool. It gives you multiple different ways to assess the body language and interaction that you're seeing. And based on if they are one, two, or three, we say, yes, it's okay to proceed with what you're doing. Yes, it's okay to proceed what you're doing with caution for twos. And three means you need to stop what you're doing and make a new plan. And it's pretty straightforward. And then we, have three different types of training. So we categorized training, which is like anathema to me, but I think it helps people. Like, I think it helps. I don't like feeling constricted in that way myself. But as an educator, my students give me feedback that they find that kind of thing really helpful. So I'm putting it out there. If I have a one, type one dog, there's type one training techniques that are fine and safe to do with type one dogs in general. If I have a type two dog, those type one training techniques are no longer available to me. I gotta do type two or type three training. If I have a type three dog, type one and type two training are not available to me, and I gotta go type three training or sedation. That's it. And there, of course, will be overlap. Like, this is an imperfect situation where, like I said, we're oversimplifying, but I think it's a really good starting point guideline for people to say, okay, level three, is it a medical need or is it something that I want to do? If I just want to do it, how necessary is that want? Like, I want to give you a rabies shot because you're due for a rabies shot is different from I want to give you a rabies shot because your owner is moving to Hawaii in 183 days and I have 48 hours to be able to do this for you.
Totally,
So
completely.
there's shades of gray there. But is it a want? Is it a need? If it is a want, is it like a really necessary want or is it something that could take a long time and that won't matter? And where do I go from there based on what my skills are, what my knowledge is, what tools are available to me? And what's the client's preference? And how I determine what the end point is of the interaction depends a lot on the client. So when I have clients come to me that see me at the veterinary office or through my personal consulting business just for the purposes of training for vet care. The first three things that that animal needs to be able to do is wear a basket muzzle, be held sufficient to be sedated. That's it. And I do not care who you are. I don't care how happy you are to go to the vet. I don't care how sad you are to go to the vet. These are the things that I teach first for every pet. And the reason for that is if they need to go to the emergency clinic, that's what they need to be able to do. In an emergency, when you have needed care that you actually need, those are the three things that will keep humans and dogs safe. So that's what I teach first. Sometimes
So,
that's the end point. Some clients, that's their full end point.
yeah.
And that's success for them. And that's okay. Cooperative care doesn't mean that you have to train 150,000 different super sexy behaviors. It's perfectly okay to just figure out how do I get out of this without causing harm? And that's success. That's okay.
I would like again louder for the people in the back. This is not necessarily about training a bunch of sexy behaviors. You can and do train a lot of sexy behaviors. I've seen them. It's all over the YouTube channel. It's fabulous. And also, it's okay that Felix, for instance, can wear a basket muzzle. He's easily restrained by me. He's less easily restrained by others. So that is something Fine. That is kind of on the docket. But I also have a good relationship with the staff. He's very comfortable in a basket muzzle. And therefore, he can be sedated. We actually quite easily sedate him for things that we need to do. Because I'm me, I'm constantly working on this. And we talked about this the last time I had you on, as far as the challenge of like bringing another body into the situation, that I feel like that's my constant problem, because we're at the point where I can inject him easily. I don't even need anybody to restrain him for that. He will stand for an injection Yep. if it is me. But I do consider it success that I don't feel, because we have a sedation procedure for him that works, I don't feel like that I'm just going to wake up in the middle of the night with a panic because what if? Because I know that we have things that can be done that do work.
Right.
And that is success.
Right. You're like, okay, what if I'm hiking and my dog breaks their leg? Mm-hmm. I have a plan and I can solve that. There are many people with many dogs out there that don't have a plan for that. And it is unsafe for yeah. the pet. And it's very unsafe for the veterinary staff.
Yeah. I was just speaking to another professional today, actually, whose client dog went into a specialist because the dog's got pretty severe hip dysplasia and they're looking at some surgery for him. It's part of his behavior problems is that he's in pain. So they are wanting to pursue that. But a good plan was not made up front. So they just kind of marched him into the specialty clinic. He was quite fractious and they basically sent them out. They basically said, we can't treat this dog. We can't even examine this dog. Like, they basically just turned them around. My colleague is asking me, like, is that normal? I was like, well, here's the thing. Like, they're well within their right to say, no, this is not a safe dog for our staff. And also, that needs to be approached in a completely different way. I was like, does the dog have a sedation protocol with the primary? She said, well, yes. I said, well, then how come that wasn't roped into a conversation before any of this happened? Anyway, that's a total tangent, as I do. But I love you kind of saying that basically, if we have a plan to get this animal needed treatment, we have success. That is the bare bones that you must have.
Correct.
And from there, you can train all kinds of really cool stuff if you want to.
Heck yeah. Yeah. So many cool things.
And that's where we're going to cut the conversation for this week. Next week, Monique and I will continue. We will get deeper into practical training application for cooperative care. And we'll have a few philosophical meanderings. So I hope you'll join me then. And don't forget to grab the textbook, Cooperative Veterinary Care, from Wiley Blackwell, linked in the notes. And of course, check out Monique's YouTube channel and website too. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. I hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe wherever you heard this podcast. And don't forget to join Patreon at patreon.com/cogdogradio. And if you're interested in more content like the stuff you heard here, I hope you'll check out my online courses, my membership, and all of my offerings at my website, sarahstreming.com. See you there.